Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
I'm very grateful to Martin Simmons, actually, because without him, we would have missed the news that following the fact that last week we were talking about your actual trip to the legendary Wheelie Festival.
To Wheelie!
In 1971.
Clacton-on-Sea.
50, count them, 5-0, 50 years ago. But Martin gets in touch to say that on Monday, I didn't realize this, there's a Wheelie tribute festival close to the site of the original. And we've just been having a look at the website.
I'm just looking at it now. Hilarious.
It's tribute acts, isn't it, basically?
Yeah, it's an Ed Sheeran tribute act. The Spice Girls with a Z. There's an Oasis band who look absolutely nothing like them. What else have we got? Is it Dave as Rod Stewart?
It's Dave as Rod Stewart. It's Dave singing, "Do You Think I'm Sexy?" That's basically what it is. But I was particularly intrigued by looking at the, at seeing how the tariff, shall we call it that, compares and contrasts with your experience back in 1971. I'm looking at the options here. You can get an adult VIP ticket for £23 plus the £3 booking fee. You can get a child VIP ticket. The idea that a child is VIP is interesting. £15 plus £2 booking fee. And then my personal favourite, the OAP VIP.
Of course. That's great, the free deck chair.
They're sold out, sadly. That's £17.
They would be. Well, they'll be all be survivors of the original campaign. They'll be people my age. Mind you, we didn't get an inflatable side, head massage, paintball, a boutique market, henna tattoos, shooters.
So they're psychology. I think the parking is £6 plus a booking fee. Yeah, there it is. Car parking, £6 plus £1 booking fee. Now, how much was it for you to go to the original?
Well, I think I've got a feeling it was £2, but then I've also got a feeling it was less than that on the door, as it were. I think it was £1.50. But you didn't get much for your £1.50. But I mean, you did get, as we said last week, wall-to-wall music starting at Friday evening and ending 24 hours a day later on Monday morning. So we got a pretty good deal.
You did get kept awake for 48 hours, didn't you?
We did. We were happy.
Yeah, you were happy.
I'm just looking at a poster that Jeremy Vine, I think it was, tweeted the other day. He said he thought one of the best festival lineups he'd ever been to was Reading Rock Festival in 79. I'm going to read you this very quickly. 1979, Reading. I reviewed it for the NME.
I was there.
In 78. You might have been there.
No, I wasn't.
I reviewed it for the NME in 78 when it was kind of Sham 69 versus The Jam and all that kind of stuff. But look, this is amazing. Friday night, you got The Police, The Tourists, Wilco Johnson, The Cure.
Go slowly, Gotham.
Okay, The Police, yeah, The Tourists. Yeah. Remember Annie Lennox?
I certainly do.
Wilco Johnson, Pete Coombs, that's right.
Eddie Chin.
And Jim Do It To Me.
We've named all five members of the Tourists.
I went on the road with the Tourists. I went on the road with them down to Bristol Colston Hall, as we were still allowed to call it then, in a van.
Brief digression on the Tourists. Wasn't Pete Coombs the kind of leading light?
He was the person
who wrote the songs. Yeah.
Yeah, he was the kind of Brian Jones of the group. He actually thought of himself as Brian Jones.
So talk about, you know, having his thunder stolen. He really did.
It all ended in tears. They fell out really badly.
I think so.
I know. Very sad. But anyway, the Tourists were third. They had a hit, didn't they?
I only want to be with you.
Wilco Johnson third. The Cure.
Right.
I mean, on fourth on the bill. That's pretty good. 1979. You wanted to do that. Doll by Doll, who were fantastic.
Yeah.
Punishment of Luxury, a.k.a. Punny Lux.
Punny Lux.
Yeah. Yeah, the Jags.
Oh, it sounds like a vacuum cleaner. The Jags.
The Jags, a lot of straight ties, a lot of thin lapels.
Skinny ties, thin lapels, rolled back sleeves. Signed to Ireland, came from Scarborough.
Did they? Linen jackets.
Their hit was called, what was it called, Mark?
I
got your number written on the back of my head.
That's the one. Yes. My God.
It was a kind of Elvis Costello light, wasn't it?
It was.
Yeah.
And then we had Bite the Pillow, amusingly titled after presumably the Jeremy Thorpe court case.
Oh, good grief, was it?
Is that the name of that man, Bite the Pillow? I think so.
God, I forgot.
I know it became a kind of hilarious comment at the time. And Motorhead with the special guest. That's just Friday night, right? Wow.
So that's the warm-up, basically.
This is fantastic. So Saturday night, you've got Thin Lizzy. That's good, isn't it? Thin Lizzy in 1979. Mm. Steve Hackett, Inner Circle. Who I remember pretty fondly.
Reggae group, Capital.
Ian Gillan, Bram Tchaikovsky, again another group that I went on the road with.
Is that Bram Tchaikovsky's of the Battle Axe?
No, it's just he says just Bram Tchaikovsky.
Just him on his own.
Battle Axe may well have tragically split, but then there was the Movies, a fairly unknown group. I think signed to Warner Brothers. A guy called Jamie Lane on drums, I can remember. The Yachts. Okay, they were good.
Henry Priestman,
exactly. Major pod listener.
Yeah.
A group called Fame and Cheap Trick. And that's not bad.
Cheap Trick.
This whole thing is £10.95, okay?
Can you name all four members of Cheap Trick?
God, no.
You see, there were people right now walking dogs in parks or whatever, or on running machines going, yes, I can.
Sir.
Me, sir. Yes, you got it right, sir. You were the collie.
Go on, do it.
Park. Okay. Rick Nielsen.
Yeah.
Bun E. Carlos. Robin Zander. No, not Robin Zander. Somebody Zander. And oh God, who's the other good looking one? I failed in my quest to name all four members.
But that to do three quarters of Cheap Trick is pretty.
No, the ugly ones at the back, Bunny Carlos and Rick Nielsen. And there was a guy called Zobin Zander and somebody. Oh God, I can't again mixing up the names.
How do you remember? Actually, I can only really remember the groups that either ones I really loved or ones that whose captions I had to write out on rock magazines.
I can probably do
your Big Country or something like that. I can probably do, you know, those kind of people who you just constantly...
Here we go. I've got them. Robin Zander was really good looking blonde guy.
All right.
And then the other good looking guy was Tom Peterson, who's a bass player. But then the kind of the geeks were Rick Nielsen and Bun E. Carlos. So anyway, carry on. They had Cheap Trick. Come.
Cheap Trick. That's Sunday night. Okay. Okay. Well, you think it's certainly tailing off? I don't think so. We've got Peter Gabriel, huge deal in 1979, riding on the top of various hits. We've got Whitesnake, who I've just been listening to an old classic pod for us to re-promote that we must have done about, I think, 2012. We interview a guy called Guy Pratt. Remember the wonderful Guy Pratt?
Oh, we do.
Bass player. And he's so funny. He talks about being in Whitesnake for a while. And now David Coverdale, he does this brilliant impersonation of David Coverdale. He's actually got rather a posh voice. And was he a public school boy? I can't remember, but he's very posh.
He came from North Yorkshire.
But he actually speaks rather posh, you know. And he calls the band Witter Snarky.
He's wonderful.
And he says things like, he said he remember him introducing one song when they were playing in Japan. It was the encore. And he goes on stage, he says, what say you that we kick the shit out of this one and fuck off directly afterwards? Which is pretty good, isn't it? So anyway, you also got Climax Blues Band.
Oh. Right.
They were great. I love Climax Blues
Band. Managed by Miles Copeland.
Miles Copeland, absolutely.
Their hit record was Couldn't Get It Right. Really good record. Really good tune. Very uncharacteristic, because mainly what they did was blues jams. But anyway, carry on.
The Members, a little bit of punk rock for you. Beards, Rat Up a Drain Pipe, Offshore Banking Business, etc.
Yeah.
Wild Horses, I can't really remember Wild Horses, actually. It is starting to tail off slightly now, isn't it?
Wild Horses sound to me like a kind of one of those identikit metal hard rock groups that were put together from the fragments of Thin Lizzy or people who left those groups.
Yes, probably was. It's anyway, go on. Zane Griff, which I do remember that name.
Oh, God, yeah.
Zane Griff, I see that as being a slightly glam metal band, but I might be wrong. The Speedometers, After the Fire, and then Molly Hatchet, and then the Ramones. I mean, that's fantastic, isn't it?
Molly Hatchet followed by the Ramones.
By the Ramones, I know. That's great. Zane Griff, 95 all in.
Zane Griff is a singer-songwriter who was part of the English New Wave and New Romantic scene of the early 1980s.
Okay, I'm miles
Well, I don't know. Raised in New Zealand, moved to England in the 70s. Worked with Lindsay Kemp. And there you go. So Molly Hatchet, I'm trying to imagine that. It's a bit of a change of gear. Molly Hatchet to the Ramones.
Yeah, that's, go off stage and on come the brothers. That's fantastic, isn't it?
That's amazing.
I covered it for the NME, the Reading Festival, the year before. They had twin stages. So they had the Jam setting up a play on one, and they were setting up Sham 69 or whatever it was on the other. And the press, little tiny press triangle was in between. And eventually there was a fight. The kind of Jam fans kind of had a go at the Sham army. And met in the press enclosure for a kind of full-on battle. I remember we all had to flee and had to hide under the stage. And people coming in with kind of the... I think there was blood drawn. I mean, it was really quite exciting.
So
actually.
One louder wishes to know, the Leeds Reading Festival, would we go? He wants to know. Would we go?
Well, would we go if we were how old?
16.
If we were 16, we'd be there like a shot, wouldn't we?
I suppose so.
Of course, you were into the rite of passage. Reading has to be your first festival. It was mine. Absolutely. Yeah. 1971, I think it was. 1970.
But nowadays, we would, we might go to a rendezvous with a grandchild on the M4 or something.
That's right. Pick them up from a lay-by.
Pick them up.
Mud caked, unrecognizable.
I don't think we'd be, we'd be going. We'll be going for our own fun. I'm looking at these other questions we got in from somebody, and I'm trying to find who.
Oh, I saw a great one about Prague. Did you see that one?
When did
Prague start? That's a good question. And I was thinking, what are the hallmarks of Prague?
Well, let's just go through the history of the nomenclature, shall we, here?
Okay, go on. Start with that.
Because, you see, I think this is quite interesting, and it's one of those aspects of the past that comes as a bit of a surprise to the present. If you go back into the 60s, into the early 60s, bands weren't called bands, they were called groups.
Yep.
And
they weren't called acts.
They weren't called rock groups. They were called beat groups or pop groups or whatever. And then they might start being called rock groups. And then the term that was in wide use to encompass anybody with long hair who played kind of strange, unaccustomed music that probably had long, sections of jamming about it or whatever, was underground music, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That was what was called underground music for quite a while. And then...
Meaning you were proud of the fact that it wasn't very commercial.
Yes.
And you supported the fact that you applauded their commercial fame.
Absolutely. As, as indicated by the Nicky Horn radio program, your mother wouldn't like it. That was the main qualification for that music.
That's it.
The normal people thought it was odd. And then you had progressive music, which I suppose started to come into use when the jamming got more kind of, more jazzy and more in kind of classical shapes as well, and people started doing things with movements in them and so forth. So progressive.
One early arbiter of that, I still think, is Good Vibrations, just because of the length. Oh, it's not prog, but Good Vibrations is interesting in that it's got a completely different pace to it. It's got a completely different length. It's got those kind of choral symphonies in the middle. It's got a kind of sections for kind of musical exploration, which would set it aside from everything else at the time. It isn't prog, but it's sort of got some of those overtones.
It's basically it's six pieces of music whacked together.
Yes, it's got different movements. That's a good point. It's got different movements. Act one, act two, because that's very prog, isn't it?
But at least within a classical piece, the movements relate to each other. You know, the themes from the first one will reappear. The third one. You won't get that in the average piece of work by Yes. You know, it's basically, I've written the first bit. Now you can write the next bit. And then the third bit's the bass players. And then the fourth bit is drummers, and then we all come back.
Yeah, we all get a songwriting royalty. Exactly. Yes.
And so that was progressive. Now, I don't think the term prog started being used until the late 70s.
Probably not.
I think it was slightly tongue-in-cheek. I think prog was, I get the feeling prog was started to be used after punk was used.
So what do we call... I just thought of another one, actually. Days of Future Past was slightly prog in terms of being concept.
In terms of music.
But the first real prog things I remember recognising was In the Court of the Kings and Crim. Kings and Crim. Impossible to say.
That's easy
the Crimson
inside.
King, easy for you to
no,
say.
No, absolutely. That is.
I'm a gummer, surely. Set the controls, careful with that axe. 1969, fantastic.
Well, I always think of Yes.
Absolutely.
And mainly loads of solos, lots of showing off. We liked all that.
We loved all the showing off. Sitting there trying to work out the time signatures, feeling a little smug.
But also, in the case of Yes, it had a great deal of kind of showbiz about it. You know, it was melodic and it was dramatic. And, you know, it could cater for short attention spans.
Could we call it progressive then? I don't know what we call it.
That's my point. We called it progressive.
Aggressive.
And I don't think we called it prog until the late 70s.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that answers the question. I found the other question from Stuart Robin, who says that there's a band called Goat, and they've just released an album called Head Soup. Did you hear about this? Goat.
No, I haven't.
Goat's head suit.
Yeah.
And he said, any other regrettable, jokey titles? And that got me thinking, actually, Stuart, because we all like a jokey title, such as, you know, is it Frank Zappa made an album called Ship Arriving Too Late to Save a Drowning Witch?
He made one called Shake Your Booty.
Shake Your Booty.
When he was dressed up as an Arab sheikh, I've explained that when he dressed up as an Arab sheikh.
We all remember with great fondness Pete Brown's Biblocco and Things May Come and Things May Go, but the art school dance goes on forever.
Goes on forever.
I love that. We all remember My People Were Fair and Were Sky in Their Hair, but now they're content to wear stars on their brows by Tyrannosaurus Rex. We also remember Prophets, Seers and Sages, The Angels of the Ages by Tyrannosaurus Rex. And there are some of us who even remember When the Pawn Hits the Conflicts, He Thinks Like a King. What he knows throws the blows when he goes to the fight, and he'll win the whole thing before he enters the ring. There's no body to batter when your mind is your might. So when you go solo, you hold your own hand and remember that depth is the greatest fight. And if you know where you stand, then you know where to land. And you fall, it won't matter, because you'll know that you're right, by Fiona Apple.
That's right.
But I think what they all have in common is they never bothered a chart, ever.
No.
And I think there's a learning there. That if you do a funny, you know, wise guy title, it very rarely...
It comes back and bites you in the arse.
very rarely does all that well. And I think I could extend that to the album by Omar Rodriguez Lopez called Absence Makes the Heart Grow Fungus.
That's brilliant.
And which I'm sure, you know, his fans very much appreciated. But I'm not sure it ever went any further than that.
That's fantastic.
The Word Podcast, prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
So I've got out my Rolling Stones records, if anybody's watching this as well as listening to it. And I've got them on my lap, the good, the bad, and the ugly. This tattoo you Rolling Stones 40 years ago this week. 40
God
years
alive.
Ago.
Yeah.
It's extraordriary. And they've only just, it's only just struck
quite
me.
A good record. I mean, my theory used to be that they didn't really make a decent record after Black and Blue, but I'm probably wrong. Would you say I'm wrong?
I think
76, the last really great record. That was fantastic.
Well, this has got Start Me Up on it, and it's got Waiting for a Friend on it. But it was largely put together from stuff they just had hanging around at that time, because that was the beginning of the great 80s freeze between Mick and Keith, which nobody was quite sure whether they were ever going to properly resume again.
Mick nipped off and made a load of solo albums, didn't he?
He made two.
Came back slightly chastened. Tail between legs. Absolutely. Sorry. Nothing to see here.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I know.
So anyway,
Somebody posted a thing to us saying, is it still the Stones without Charlie?
Well, and, we were talking about that the other week.
Because I thought it was really interesting that imagine that Charlie had died and that they weren't, they hadn't planned to tour. They would then have to say, right, we're now officially going on the road as the Rolling Stones without Charlie. No, but actually what happened was they'd already taken the precaution, hadn't they, because he was ill, of booking in Steve Jordan, who was his drum roadie. I think I can remember his
name. Well, no, Steve Jordan had played on all sorts of people, with all sorts of people. It's just a really good session.
But he's someone recommended by Charlie. So they've already got the kind of excuse that they are going to tour with Steve Jordan. So if that works, they can then say, well, it worked, and which I'm sure it will, and we can carry on. So they're in an interesting position, aren't they? They don't have to start from scratch and make a statement about whether they're continuing. They are continuing. They were continuing anyway.
Well, I don't know. Will they still now? I wouldn't pretend to know.
Because it's one of those things, it's personal, isn't it? Do you think it constitutes the Stones? I don't think
that's
does,
my feeling, you
honest.
See. But we're the same vintage with regard to these things. So we still think that Ronnie Wood was a bit of an interloper.
Yeah, I don't think
Ronnie was a Johnny come lately. Somebody called me from a national newspaper the other day, after the sad news of the death of Charlie Watts, and said, well, it's a sad, sad day. First Rolling Stone to die. I thought, no, I don't think so. Brian Jones was
Ian Stewart,
50 years ago. Yeah, I imagine you could include Ian Stewart,
you
really.
Could, really. Yeah.
But obviously, very, very sad for clearly very sad for Charlie Watts' family and for the young people
on the news desk of national papers. And I can remember being rung up by, sent an email by somebody saying, could I write something about the sad death of Clarence Clemens? And he'd spelt Clarence wrong and he spelt Clemens wrong. I was thinking, do you know who he is? I wonder if you actually know.
But now people are speculating, will they carry on? And you wouldn't be surprised if they did, because there is a streak of cussedness about Mick and Keith when it comes to these things, don't you be telling us when's the right and the dignified point to draw this to a close.
Completely.
Because I can't see them making an announcement of any kind.
No, I can't.
You know what I mean?
And it's what they do, and it's their prerogative. And my feeling is if you don't approve, don't go. That's fine.
Oh, absolutely.
But a lot of people do approve. I mean, it's like there must be a lot of people who went to see The Who who didn't have a rhythm section either and just had two members of the original team alive and thought that was fine. Danny Baker tweeted this fantastic thing the other day. I don't know if you saw that about Paul, the availability of Paul McCartney and Ringo Starr.
Yes.
See, now this is good. He did it facetiously and said, well, why doesn't Paul and Ringo just step in and help? Then he suddenly thought, that is a fantastic idea. This is the ultimate tribute act, where they can do 50% Stone songs and 50% Beatles.
They can do I Want to Be a Man, can't they?
Wouldn't it be amazing? And they could, exactly, yes.
Yeah.
I thought it was a fantastic idea.
So, who knows what will occur? Because, and also, when Rolling Stone's playing these huge stadiums full of people, 40,000, 50,000 people, there must be 30,000 people there who have no memory of them in even the 80s.
Absolutely.
Let alone the 70s, let alone the 1960s.
Yeah.
They're just this thing that's always been there, and you should go and see while you can kind of thing, which people have been saying ever since. Ever since 1990.
Yes, it's your last chance. Hurry.
It's your last chance.
You know. Fathers take sons, you know, so, exactly.
So great Charlie moments. There he is on the cover of Get Your Yah-Yahs Out. What a curious cover that was, you know. On a,
Jewels and binoculars hang from the head of a mule. Wasn't that the gag?
That's a Bob Dylan line, isn't it? I think you've got binoculars hanging from the head of the mule. I'm not sure you got jewels
there. I thought there were jewels as well. I may be wrong, but I thought that was the gag. It was meant to allude to that line. I
don't think it deliberately does. It's just it's a donkey carrying a drum kit and a guitar. Classic Charlie on the cover here of Their Satanic Majesty's Request. You know, classic incarnation of the "Do I have to wear?
Do
this
I have to
boss?
Wear this boss?"
picture there. There he is on the cover of the Rolling Stones' second LP. Picture shot by David Bailey, I think. Yes, cover photograph. David Bailey, and on the back there, looking well turned out in the suit and tie. First Rolling Stones. The nerve. This is your first album, and all it says on the front of that record is Decca. You know what I mean? It doesn't say Rolling Stones.
It opens with a Charlie Watts drum fill, I think, doesn't it, that album?
I suppose so, yeah. Carol,
I think it is.
It probably does. And there they are. They are depicted by Guy Pillart on the cover of It's Only Rock and Roll. Sorry, I'm boring you. It's all right.
This is absolutely riveting. I love it. I love it.
This is the Rolling Stones' Sticky Fingers from 1971, so released pretty much, round about this time, 50 years ago. So that's amazing to think, actually. God, I'm just going to do that. Hang on a second, if I get that back. That is extraordinary. 50 years ago, Mark, Sticky Fingers. 40 years ago, Tattoo Year. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Only 10 years between the two. And it feels like eons, really.
It does.
It separates the two of them. What's this one called? Emotional Rescue. Yes, Emotional Rescue. Not one of those.
You should tell the story of your interview. I was watching a bit of BBC Two last night. They had a little tribute to him. And they was playing Charlie at the BBC. Of course, they put your interview in, your little clip from 25x5.
Did it? I'll tell you. Shall I tell you the full boring story?
I want the story. I know it, but I think people should hear it.
You don't know the full story, Mark Allen. Not even you know the full story. Because there's a really long story here, which is that we were making a film for, Whistle Test 1986 about the Rolling Stones, about their 25th anniversary, which at the time seemed absolutely unprecedented and amazing. A band had been together 25 years. There weren't any, you know.
No one can believe it. And the headlines in the papers were always the collective age of the Rolling Stones.
Which they still do.
They still are. Collective age is whatever it would have been then. 127 and they're still going.
It's not been interesting since 1972, that particular gag, you know.
No.
And they still do it. Anyway. And so we had a meeting with Mick at their office in Cheyne Walk. And it was agreed that they're all going to do interviews. They were all going to do individual interviews. And the joke was, even Charlie, you know, Charlie will have to do it.
Yeah.
He won't want to do it, but he'll have to do it. Mick, obviously, no trouble at all. Keith, Ronnie, no, even Bill, you know. But Charlie's going to do it. And, we tracked them all down and we did them all individually. But Charlie was always evasive, couldn't set up a time to do it at all. And so I just had to grab him during filming they were making a video for One Hit to the Body at, I think, Elstree Studios, a studio near London.
It's on the set. We're in the car park or something, isn't it?
We're in the car outside the car park. There's a sound stage, and then we're outside in the car park. And I think it's directed by Russell Mulcahy, I think. And they were saying, "Yeah, don't worry, we'll get Charlie." And Charlie was clearly trying to avoid the issue. He was going around the place like a kind of hunted animal. You know, he really didn't want to do it. But anyway, he's finally produced. And, get started in the middle of the car park. And I'm aware of the fact that over my shoulder, doing the best their best to make him laugh or to put him off or to add to his discomfiture were, of course, Keith and Ronnie, you know. The eternal 15-year-old.
I was going to say, suspended in perpetual adolescence. Nothing, the idea that they're kind of making faces over your shoulder.
Nothing's funnier. You know what I mean? Kind of pinching each other and punching each other and all that sort of. And you know what it's like. I mean, it's a nightmare doing interviews like that in the middle of car parks anyway, because you're surrounded by people. All pretending that they're not listening, but really listening like crazy, you know.
And
you go.
And Charlie has every excuse to be distracted too.
And he's distracting at him. Absolutely. And so I launched on my little bit, and you know what these things are like. You're just trying to get them to bite on something that you'll get a usable answer out of, you know.
You and do a fantastic job. Well, no, you I just kept going at it until then you tee him up at the end.
Well, hold on. And he comes first of all, I think I said, so let's talk. I thought, let's get him off the subject of the Rolling Stones. Just get him to talk about jazz or something like that. You know, because you think, oh, that's somebody's comfort zone. He can't pretend that he's being, you know, made to talk about something he's unwilling to talk about. So something like, oh, let's talk about your other career. So, what other career? Getting really stroppy.
I know.
It's like, oh, please, you know, you're doing this interview. Well, I know you've been made to do it, but it's part of your kind of your job or whatever.
It's your job.
Anyway, and we got through this. And then at the end, I don't know, I got something, it was reflecting on 25 years. And I thought, so, well, there's a lot of it's been hanging around, has it? And so, and I can't remember. I must have teed him up to say something.
You
like,
did. You said a lot has been hanging around. He says something like 20 years playing, 5 years hanging around.
No, he said 5 years playing, 20 years hanging around. But he was being. I'll tell you what it was like. And I was telling you, I was talking to Jeff the other day on Five Live about it. He's very much like the famous Bob Dylan "Never Ending Tour" quote. Which we all know came from Adrian Devoy. Adrian Devoy interviewed him for Q. And he said, so tell us about your tour. He said, which tour? He says, well, it seems to never end. He said, yeah, it never ends. And so Adrian said, so it's a never-ending tour. And Dylan said, yes. And so the quote is Adrian, probably as much as Bob Dylan, you know.
Yeah.
So this was a bit similar to that. And of course, you know, they used that in the film or whatever. And then they must have recut all that footage for, and I think it turned up in some, possibly in some kind of career retrospective, probably after 50 years or something, made for the American market, where they took my little bit and they overdubbed my voice with an American so that they could make it sound.
That's cheeky. As if they'd invented it, as if they were responsible.
Can I just go a bit
That's
further?
That's shocking.
Can I just go a bit further? It's fucking cheeky. That is really cheeky.
Did anybody ever complain?
Well, who's going to complain? You know, it's years gone, you know, it's the BBC, nobody complains.
Oh, that's wretched. That's a low trick.
So, and I'm just getting off my chest right now, you know. And so that quote, which was unwillingly dragged out of him, is now quoted absolutely everywhere.
It is. It's the one thing everyone always says about it.
And so that's the way those things go. So anyway, more Rolling Stones records. There you are, Exile on Main Street. What a great cover that still
Fantastic.
Is.
Fantastic.
And Some Girls, original cover there, Mark, before they had to withdraw Lucille Ball or whoever. There you are. There's, can I see Charlie, a little figure on the top of the cake?
Let It Bleed. Yeah.
And the cover of the cake of the cone, the cover of Let It Bleed.
By Delia Smith made the cake.
And now we have the best Rolling Stones record. No, maybe not. The first one's probably the best one. Second best one, Aftermath. What a great record.
Okay.
Aftermath is roll gold. Oh, I've got another copy of Aftermath. I've got two mono copies of Aftermath. Rolling Stones, Beggar's Banquet, great record. Goat's Head Soup. We were talking about that earlier. Through the Past, Darkly, and there he is, looking splendid. on the cover of Between the Buttons, cover taken by Gary Mankiewicz.
Interesting Charlie moments. We were talking to somebody on our quiz last night, weren't we? The Word in Your Ear quiz, who pointed out that on Honky Tonk Women, he only hits the cymbal twice.
Yes.
And I listened to it and checked it. It's true. At the very beginning, after the cowbell, there's just one strike of the cymbal, and then there's no use of cymbal till the very end. The very last note of the song is a cymbal. Isn't it interesting?
Absolutely. And there funny is. Looking splendid on the cover of Art of Our Heads. Taken, as Gerard was telling us, in Mason's Yard out the back of Gerard's old studio. Carry on. Go on.
I was going to say, it's interesting when, you know, when guitarists or keyboard players, whatever, you get people using adjectives to describe their music. It's wailing or it's elegiac, their tone, or comparing them to other musicians. But a drummer, you get lots of technical information.
Yeah.
Because you can physically see what they're doing and you want that explained to you. There's a brilliant piece by Max Weinberg I read where he talks about, also Stuart Copeland saying the one thing about Charlie Watts, he played very quietly, which I didn't realise. He played incredibly quietly, which is amplified really loud. So he has that amazing lightness of touch.
Yeah.
And that detail, if you listen
to never saw him lift
this joint.
You never saw him lift his arms, did you?
Never, ever. No. Yeah. Yeah. And he said, Max Weinberg says, and everyone always talks about how we play behind the beat, but Max Weinberg explained it really well. He said that he used this technique, the great Al Jackson, the Stax drummer, where you deliberately play behind the back beat, not by focusing on the 2 and 4 beats, but the 1 and 3. And when you listen to that, you realise that that's what gives the Stones that slightly loosh quality. Don't you think? It's like sort of slightly lazy, you know, it's slightly kind of insouciant, slovenly kind of sound. You know, it's really.
Bill Wyman said, Bill Wyman, who obviously should know, I must get this quote. It's a really good quote. He said that the Rolling Stones had a wobble.
Oh, right.
Yes. Explains the Rolling Stones wobble. Here we go. It's
cool.
Oh, it's from my. Something happens. My, yeah, I put it's on my blog. I wrote this years ago.
Oh, you wrote this? So
no, I wrote this down from something he was. Yeah, he's talking in the documentary Crossfire Hurricane, which I think is probably where my quote was used.
Yeah.
Anyway, something happens when we play together. It's impossible to copy. Every band follow the drummer. We don't follow Charlie. Charlie follows Keith. So the drums are very slightly behind Keith. It's only fractional, seconds, minuscule, and I tend to play ahead. It's got a sort of wobble. It's dangerous because it can fall apart at any moment.
That's lovely. It makes you go back and just reassess those things, which I've done. And it's all about technique. It's a lovely thing that Max Weinberg talks about where he says he takes Joe Morello to see the Rolling Stones. Joe Morello was the drummer of the Dave Brubeck Quartet.
Right.
And introduced him to Charlie because Charlie loved to meet him. And they just go off into a corner and all they talk about, there's no small talk at all, all they talk about is, how did you play the drum part on take 5? What did you do? Explain that to me. I love things like that. It's so technical, isn't it? It's just so, you know, so and so competitive.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
So you've seen the story about the Nirvana album sleeve, the Nevermind album sleeve, and without wishing, obviously, to get into a conversation about whether or not this guy has any right to take this court case, which he claims that he was exploited and damaged by the fact that his picture was used.
Spencer Eldon,
25 years ago.
Who appeared as a three-month-old child or whatever.
I thought it was interesting that Spencer Eldon has, if you have a look at him, he's actually promoted his relationship with this record on a few occasions, one of which was turning up on the program Nevermind the Buzzcocks, where he gives a little interview the day before saying how much he's looking forward to going. It's going to be a lot of fun to be on this program. And he's in the Identity Parade. You know that thing where you have to guess which one it is, which one's the guy who was the baby on the cover. And I think about 4 or 5 of them turn up, I think naked, apart from something obviously covering up any important parts. And so he's there, he is clearly very keen to talk about his association with this thing. But and now taking a court case. I mean, it's a pretty phenomenal story, isn't it? I mean,
he claims that he was never paid for appearing on the cover.
They got 200 quid for it, didn't they?
And that apparently his parents never signed a release form. Now, if so, I bet there's some some arses are being kicked at Geffen Records nowadays.
It's possible
if
because
somebody
they got
didn't sign a release form, you know.
Yeah, they got it from the photographer, didn't they? I think
no, they what? Shot it for they shot it. For
it
the
was
cover.
Shot. For that.
Yeah, well, that's according to the account I'm looking at. But his parents never signed a release form, although, as you say, he was perfectly happy with it. But the thing I wanted to really take issue with this, and I want to ask Alex's view on this, actually. He claims that the lawsuit claims the image is sexually graphic and says it makes Eldon resemble a sex worker grabbing for a dollar bill. And was it ever seen as sexually graphic? I don't remember it being. No. It was kind of seen as being innocent, wasn't it? This is a baby swimming as a dollar bill on you. That's just a kind of gag, you know.
It was a comment on capitalism, wasn't it?
I suppose.
Yeah,
it wasn't seen as
sexually.
We're
all motivated by money.
Yeah.
But clearly some lawyers come along, had a whisper in this chap's ear and turned his head. And promised a load of cash, no doubt.
So. Well, yeah, which I'm sure he could probably guess. You know, I'm no expert, but you know that.
Well, if they didn't sign a release form, that's interesting.
Because it's not about the record; it's about the image. And you know, I bet they're selling that image on T-shirts. You know that they're probably related to what we're talking to Eamon Ford. You know, the other week on his book about leaving the building, about rock and roll estates. That you end up being the bulk of the earning is in fashion items, is in posters. It's not in music at all. And Nirvana, although interestingly enough, they never sought this. You know, everything that they said was we don't care about that side of things at all. It ended up earning them a fortune, didn't it? You know, Nirvana logos and you know the image on that first album.
The smiley face with the crossed out eyes.
Yeah, all that stuff. All those kind of.
Interestingly, did you know this chap has? I believe he has a tattoo of the Nevermind font.
He does.
Yeah.
See, I think that's going to be quite hard to when that's brought to
you. It's not going to turn well in court, is it?
I think so.
Except that, you know, if they didn't sign a release and the sum of money wasn't fair, he might be able to get somewhere. I don't know. But I just thought it was interesting, this argument that the sexually graphic, because I think it sort of relates to the other, you know, controversial old album covers that often get, you know, pulled out in this context. Which are things like the end of the Blind Faith album cover from 1969, or Jimi Hendrix's Electric Ladyland, or Led Zeppelin's Houses of the Holy. I don't think they were ever seen as particularly sexually graphic.
Not
at all.
Remotely. You know, they're not remotely.
Kind of modern representations of you know, like cherubs and cherub illustrations.
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah.
You know, if you think about
people, they raise the eyebrows a bit. But, you know, you take Houses of the Holy, which is another, you know, the one that's sort of controversial. You know, that was seen as kind of innocent and
wow. That was art. That was a piece of art, wasn't it?
And have you heard of the album that Halsey's just released?
No.
An artist called Halsey, and she's just released a record which contains an image of her with baby on lap, with her naked breast exposed. And her argument is it's, you know, it's all about it's empowerment and
well, they say that it's always it's anything nowadays. If you want to defend anything, you say it's empowering. That's just what you do. Nobody said that pre 10 years ago. They said something different, you know, and it'll be something different in another 10 years' time. So that's just that's the way of the times. Although talking of courting controversy, Mark, did you look at the clip of Kanye West doing his latest listening party for his album?
Oh, where he sets himself on fire
in front of a mere 40,000 people.
I know. What I was amazed about that is that nobody at any point suggested it might not be him. You know, because news stories tend to just go along with whatever makes the best news story. They're not gonna burst the bubble by checking any facts. No insurance company in a gazillion years would ever allow Kanye West to appear to be even slightly on fire.
You may be right.
They must have swapped it with somebody, and he must have gone out on stage and apparently been burning. But
I was intrigued by the fact that he appeared. Two people that he chose to appear with him, apart from his. Is she estranged wife, Kim Kardashian, who apparently, according to the report I saw, was there to support her husband. No, she bloody wasn't. She was there to get some more publicity.
More publicity, entirely.
It's as simple as that. Anyway, he appeared. He chose two people to appear with him on this occasion. And one was the rapper DaBaby, who's been in somewhat hot water over the last 2 weeks after launching into some rant about people with AIDS and gay people or whatever.
Yeah.
And the other is the always controversial Marilyn Manson. You know,
who was dropped by his record label, wasn't
it? Well, just terrible.
All sorts of terrible allegations involving women. Yeah.
And so the idea of Kanye West just thinks, I can't get sufficient publicity out of setting myself on fire in front of 40,000 people. I know I'll get these two guys along as well.
Roping a couple of other people, exactly.
But it is just extraordinary. You know, it's a listening party. It's basically a live advertising stunt, isn't it? It's kind of beyond advertising. It's sort of the record itself doesn't matter. It's just the event. He's done a load of these, and he'll probably continue doing them. You know what I mean? It's all just drawing attention to you, isn't it? You know, keeping
Kanye's brand is essentially being bonkers these days, isn't it?
I suppose it is.
How can he up the bonkers for the next?
Up the bonkers.
I think it's a genius idea in terms of drawing attention to yourself, to set yourself on fire.
Yeah, that's true.
Look at me.
Now, talking of people setting themselves on fire on album covers, because they're going from the guy Spencer Eldon, you know, who appeared on the Nirvana album.
Are you talking about the album Big Floyd?
The people who ended up being famous because of their appearance on album covers. The two guys on the cover of Pink Floyd's Wish You Were Here, Ronnie Rondell and Danny Rogers, who are two Hollywood stuntmen who specialised in setting themselves
on fire. Who really are on fire. Seriously, that's not airbrushed, is it?
This is not, because you see, I did some work on making a film about hypnosis. The sleeve designers, and I spoke to Aubrey Powell about this, who photographed that. And because the thing about hypnosis back in the day is all their extraordinary stunts, they actually did it
in the real world. Fly a pig over. I mean, it's incredible now, doesn't it?
You know, absolutely everything they did. You know, they when they wanted to have somebody swimming in a phone box. They got a phone box. They filled it with water and put somebody in it. That's how you did it.
Yeah.
Before the days of Photoshop. Whereas now, so half the appeal of looking at those things, and yeah, I don't even remember Wish You Were Here when it first appeared. It came in a black vinyl wrap round. Do you remember this, Mark?
Yeah, I do.
Which had a sticker on the outside saying Pink Floyd, Wish You Were Here. And then you ripped it off. So you took this beautiful kind of stuff and you just ripped it off, and then the next thing you saw was two guys shaking hands, one of whom was on fire.
One of them on fire.
And this was like whenever it was, 1976, 77 or something like that. And so when you looked at images like that in those days, you went, oh my God, look at that. And I don't think you do that any longer because
no, you don't.
Because absolutely everything is, you can, you know, it's Photoshop or it's digitally reworked or whatever. You can never have the same trust in the image, can you, anymore?
No, you can't. I used to have a picture in the kitchen of my old mate Tom Hibbert interviewing Margaret Thatcher, which I think was quite funny. Said. And then suddenly got to a point where I had to take it down because people would look at it and go, oh, very, very clever. Oh, yes. That's clever, isn't it? Well, and why bother? Why bother to do that? You know, it happened.
It's
it really
real.
Happened.
It's real.
It's funny. It struck me, thinking of all the people who were on covers, it's just random people who turned up on album covers. One is that guy Paul Cole, who's the American tourist, 60-year-old American tourist. There he is on the cover of Abbey Road. And I think that's really interesting because we now know, you and I, from doing podcasts and talking to the people who did the artwork for this record, that they changed the colour of the sky.
Well, so they made it bluer.
So if they could do that, was it not possible back in those days to remove people? I guess it wasn't, because you think what you do is
It would have been a lot of work to do it. And I don't think there's any point, because also there's some decorators for the other side of the road, you know, in white
overalls. Yeah, there are, actually. That's true. Yes, that's true. You know,
and I mean, the obvious thing to do would have been to move the car. For yeah. God's sake. Because if anybody was shooting an album cover nowadays, I think I'm right in saying that it was going to be a big album cover.
Yeah.
And it had a car on it that they didn't have an agreement with the car manufacturer to have
to
the
use
car.
That number plate.
To have the car.
To have the itself, car.
There. They'd say, no, get rid of it.
Yeah.
Get rid of it. You can't put anything in any of those pictures that you don't kind of own or control.
Whereas, and that car's had a life of its own, isn't it? It's in a
VW museum in Germany.
That's right.
But the guy who owns it is still with us. He got in touch after I wrote a thing in the Radio Times about this a couple of years ago. But yes, Paul Cole died a few years ago, you know, and he gave interviews for the rest of his life about having been the man on the cover of Abbey
Road. I love it. It's really detailed. It's all about how he'd gone out and bought a new blazer and did the sales.
Yes.
And he's standing there waiting for his wife. And he looks around and he said, I just had to look up and I saw these guys walking across the street like a line of ducks, a bunch of kooks, because they were all rather radical looking at the time. And he didn't walk around London barefoot. Just lovely idea. And then years later, somebody points out to him, that's you, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, you on the cover of Abbey Road.
Which is an incredible thing to happen, you know.
The other one here I've got is the cover of Bob Dylan, John Wesley Harding, and you know, because this appeared at the height of psychedelia, when absolutely the Beatles had done Sgt. Pepper, where you were encouraged to know who everybody was on the cover, you know, it was a puzzle, and then Bob Dylan appears with this, and you think, who the hell's these guys with Bob Dylan? And these two either side of him are the Balls of Bengal.
That's right.
The Indian folk musicians who were spending time in Woodstock, and I think Albert Grossman was managing them at the time. And the other unaccountable person here is a guy called Charlie Joy, who's just behind Bob Dylan, who was a carpenter and kind of handyman. And he just happened, that picture was taken in the garden of Sally Grossman's house in Woodstock. On a day when it was like 20 below, unbelievably cold. And Charlie Joy just happened to be working on the place. And so Bob Dylan said, come and get in the picture. And he ended up being on the cover of John Wesley Harding.
And there's another person down the bottom, isn't there, that Sid Griffin pointed out to us. You can see the cowboy hat of the person who's kneeling down at the front, who's been cut out of the picture.
Oh, good grief, right?
Yeah, there he is. So there's another person there. It's absolutely
fantastic.
Extraordinary.
And then there are the people who were there very deliberately. The Kate Murta.
Oh, yeah, Kate Murta on the
is the woman who holds the torch or the glass of Coca-Cola or whatever it is on the cover of Supertramp's Breakfast in America.
Kate Murta was an actress and a musician. She'd been in various musicals and things, and she was actually in the film of Breakfast at Tiffany's, which made me think that's possibly why she got the job. Really interesting.
Another one I like is the
Meat is Murder cover. And the cover of that was a guy who was an American Marine and photographed while he was out in Vietnam. And he had Make Love, Not War written on his helmet. And they used that picture and changed it to Meat is Murder. And his sister was out shopping in a shopping mall and suddenly saw this thing and brought it back and said, isn't this you? And he was absolutely astonished because, of course, nobody asked your permission. You know, there you are. Nobody would ever know it was him. But he was just amazed that they used that thing and that they changed the wording, you know.
That's quite something.
Yeah. And there's obviously Peter Bowen, who's on the cover of the U2 records.
Oh, yes.
Who's on War and on Boy.
Yeah.
And but one of my other favourites is this is Hardcore by Pulp. And there's a girl on the cover of that who's called Xenia Sobchak. And she was a socialite, actress and politician who eventually ran against... Do you remember? It's a kind of slightly pornographic image of her in the red satin dress. You know?
Yeah.
She then ran against Vladimir Putin in the 2018 Russian presidential election. Incredible, really.
And didn't win, obviously.
Youngest presidential candidate in Russian history. Isn't that amazing that she's the girl on the cover of This is Hardcore, you know?
I love all this stuff.
I do, too.
Because you don't get this with CDs. You know, nobody ever goes.
Nobody
Look at that person on the cover of that CD. It's always the LP. So, Alex, you're off to sea.
I am, yes.
You got your kit bag over your shoulder. You've written to your mum. You're going to be... Alex goes occasionally to be a cabin boy, you know, on a pirate ship.
And are they letting you off at all? It's 3 months, isn't it? Is it 3 months? Two and a half, three months?
Yeah. As things stand...
How often do you get to shore?
Well, we dock at a port every day, pretty much. This particular stint is a sort of circle around the Western Med, predominantly, sort of tottering between Spain and Italy, broadly. And we'll be somewhere every day, but as things stand, because of the current situation, we've been told that crew at the moment are not allowed to get off the ship. I suppose it's because...
That's right, that's what you told me. So I thought you are actually pretty much shipbound, aren't you, for two or three months?
Well, passengers can get off with an accredited shore excursion, so they can go off to do...
That's hardly liberation,
though. Well, I don't know, because...
You've got to go around a ruin.
You dock in Naples, you're going to want to see Pompeii. Do you know what I mean? So you have to go for a specific purpose and not go outside your bubble. And yeah. I mean, there are tons of things you can do. Old Alex from the Beatles getting off to go to H&M to buy some socks. It doesn't really kind
That's
of...
That's not very high on the list of priorities. No.
So I've found myself in a curious position of having to pack for a solid 3 months, which has been interesting.
So you've dry cleaned your Beatles suits.
Dry cleaned my suits, got them retailored, got the, you know, made sure I've got the requisite amount of socks plus some spare socks. Key, as we all know. Ready to go. We're in the Isle of Wight at the moment. Currently in a little hotel in Newport. We're rehearsing in Ryde. Literally got a ticket to Ryde.
That's where the Beatles got their idea, isn't it?
It was, yeah. They used to go down and see what Paul's uncle...
Yeah, no, it was John's, yeah. John's auntie, wasn't it?
Not Paul's uncle, John's auntie.
I think it was John's auntie, wasn't it? Mimi. Well, maybe I'm wrong. But somebody actually had a ticket to Ryde, R-Y-D-E, didn't they? And that's how the idea was. I'm going to take it to Ryde. Fantastic.
I got hovercraft here yesterday, which is fun.
Right. I didn't know they were still going.
No, yeah. That's amazing.
So they sort of get put into the holding pen. And all
so
sudden,
you do. So you, they really do cane up off the sea, up the beach, and into the shed. Presumably,
it's absolutely terrifying.
Isn't that amazing?
It's coming to attack. You know, this thing just leaps out of the sea onto the beach and sort of deflates itself.
It wasn't choppy or anything like that, because people always say hovercrafts and choppy.
That's why they didn't work commercially. People felt really ill on hovercrafts. It was when they were choppy. Such a good idea. Yeah,
pretty smooth. I mean, it went really fast as well. Actually,
right.
But it was a calm day. You know, I'd imagine in November it's a bit of a different story. But
so this time we meet you, you'll be on the ocean wave.
Are we wearing my pirate hat?
Little
plastic pirate on my shoulder.
Stowed away.
We shall look forward to that, Alex.
What's a pirate's favourite letter?
I don't know. What's a pirate's favourite letter?
Or something. No, go on.
No, it's not R, it's the C, loves.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.